Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. I want to give a quick shout out to our wonderful sponsor, eToro. The best way to be smart about trading crypto is to use the smartest trading platform. eToro is one of the largest trading platforms in the world, with over $1 trillion in trading volume on the platform per year. U.S. customers can trade the most popular crypto assets with extraordinarily low fees. And if you're not ready to trade yet, you can practice on the platform with their virtual trading feature. Best of all, you could connect with 11 million other eToro traders around the world to discuss trading, charts, and all things crypto. You can create an account at b.tc/eToroReaction or click the link below in your show notes. Just scroll down on your phone, click the eToro link, and it'll bring you right to their website. With that, let's jump into the episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Today I'm thrilled to have on Amir Haleem, who's the CEO and co-founder of Helium. I'm thrilled to have Amir on because I used to co-cover cloud and telecom at Oppenheimer on the equity research team. So it's kind of right up the alley of crypto and telecom. Amir, how's it going?
It's good. Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So Amir, let's fill everybody in. What's your background?
Yeah, my background has nothing to do with telecoms. I've mostly spent my career in the video game industry. Back in the old days, I used to be I guess what would now be considered an esports professional in the Quake universe. That's a long time ago. That was like the 90s or something. And then I worked at a startup that ended up creating Battlefield 1942, which became a really big game franchise for EA. So it was acquired in as part of working on that. And then I've worked at just various startups doing various things in the video game world until about 6 or 7 years ago when we started looking at telco infrastructure and how we might build a network for sensors, basically. So my background has absolutely nothing to do with this. But in some ways, I think that's perhaps served me a little bit served me well because I've been able to look at things in a slightly different way than the traditional way, perhaps.
Hey, I loved Battlefield 2142. That definitely came after 1942, but I was fully addicted to it.
Yeah, that was way after my time. But even the way that something like Battlefield 1942 came to be is sort of amusing because we had a game before that called Codename Eagle, and it was this first person shooter that was set in like World War I era, and it's mostly a single player game, but it had this multiplayer part to it as well. And it was really, really broken, right? There was like so many bugs in the multiplayer part. And one of the bugs allowed you to like stand on the wing of a plane, for example. And so that's like how the idea for 1942 came to be, is that it was just so much fun playing in the office in this sort of broken way where like you had a gunner basically on the wing of your plane that just sort of standing there. So it's just funny. I'm always like reminded that like some of the most amazing things come out of just like pure accident sometimes. But that was definitely one of them.
Yeah, no, for sure. And Amir, I want to dive into all the dynamics around Helium, but I think it would be helpful just to set the stage and kind of get the elevator pitch from you on what Helium is.
Helium is an attempt to build a decentralized wireless network, right? We think that the current way that wireless networks get built, and when I'm talking about wireless networks, I'm mostly talking about cell networks today, right? So networks that live outdoors. So not your Wi-Fi network at home or not anything connected to Bluetooth, but sort of broad scale outdoor wireless networks. They've really only been built one way for like the longest period of time, right? Like they're always built by sort of a big telco that spends billions and billions of dollars doing this. And that has, I think, led to a lot of different problems. Some of those problems are a little bit more nuanced, right? So things like there aren't really many great options for low power devices to connect. That started to improve in recent times, but it's been difficult for that market to be served well just because the economics are challenging, right? Like you're not going to spend tens of billions of dollars building network infrastructure when a sensor that wants to pay $1 a year is your user at the end of the day, right? And so there have been challenges from sort of an economic point of view. Just sort of philosophically, I think it's troubling that sort of the sort of access to the internet is always gated by, you know, one or two large telcos. I would love to see that change. And so, you know, our view has always been that there needs to be sort of an alternate type of network. And in recent history, we've taken the approach of sort of combining that with this sort of decentralization and cryptocurrency aspect to really try and incentivize anyone, like random consumers, individuals, entrepreneurs, to become their own network operators and sort of act as their own telco.
No, that's huge. And I think people forget about how big the value chain for wireless networks are, right? I mean, you have, you know, thousands of spots where American Tower and Crown Castle have to buy real estate. You have the fiber providers, you have, you know, all of the cell spectrum that costs billions of dollars, and then all of the infrastructure that goes into the devices. I mean, when you're thinking about kind of taking that on, I mean, isn't that a huge hurdle to kind of go up against?
I mean, it's crazy, right? I mean, if it's on the face of it, it's a ridiculous idea, except that it's not when you sort of get into it, right? And so I think you're absolutely correct in focusing on American Tower and Crown Castle as sort of key players in the universe. And if your listeners aren't fully aware of who those people are, they're effectively cell tower leasing companies, right? So they own a bunch of real estate and they've intelligently built cell towers or built tower and power infrastructure. And then they lease that to companies like Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile. And so I think that's the biggest cost, right? Is that somewhere and somehow you have to get access to a lot of real estate and a lot of locations. And so our view of that is that there's actually a very different way to do that. And that's by incentivizing everyday people or consumers or entrepreneurs to sort of become their own version of that. But it comes at a cost, right? And the cost is that we don't own the network, right? And so for Verizon, that's not an acceptable cost, right? Because their whole business is predicated on the fact that they're a network operator. For us, we're trying to like build a model, which is a very unproven model. I mean, who knows if it's actually going to work, but I think it should work. Where, you know, we assist in sort of building this ecosystem and participate in it ourselves. And if we succeed in that, then, you know, that's a huge pie, right? I mean, the telco universe is measured in trillions of dollars. And so we don't have to be wildly successful in order to share in that in a big way.
That's a good point. And just walk us through kind of how this works, just at a high level. I mean, so I buy a node. Like I buy a Helium node, I plug that in, and is it just basically plug and play? And I have, you know, I'm adding coverage and capacity to kind of your IoT network?
That's exactly how it works. So we have a product called the Helium Hotspot. It's available for sale today. I think they ship pretty much immediately. We've sold a few thousand of these things already. And the way it works is that you buy it, you stick it in your house. Ideally, you put it in a window, you put it somewhere up high. We've seen people get creative and start putting them outside with like huge antennas and stuff like that. But you don't have to do that. It's just better if you do. And then we have a simple mobile app that sort of helps you set that up, right? And so it's a very similar to something like, you know, a Google Chromecast or a Sonos or something like that. It's a very consumer-facing mobile application that's in the iOS and the Google Play Store. And then once you set it up, you connect it to your Wi-Fi or your Ethernet at home. And once you do that, you're sort of participating in this broad wireless network that's today designed for low power things, right? So this isn't a network for cell phones and laptops and tablets. It's for sensors, right? So very, very low power, low data rate kind of devices. And so you're sort of creating, the hotspot sort of creates this bridge between this low power sensor network and the internet. And the hotspot can create a pretty wide coverage area. I mean, in the best case, we've seen something like 30 miles of range from a single hotspot. And in the worst case, you know, you might be talking about a square mile or something like that if you're in a city or if you have it badly located. So I think that's sort of part of what makes it feasible, right, is that we use this wireless technology that we built called LongFi. And as a result of that, you can create, you know, a pretty big coverage area in a city with like 75 or 100 of these things. Versus needing, you know, tens of thousands if you were trying to do a 5G deployment or something like that.
No, that's awesome. I mean, I don't think people realize that all that cellular equipment that they see on top of buildings, I mean, the carriers pay a lot of money to rent out that roof space. You guys are basically, you know, giving people, or people are buying these hubs and they're just putting it in their office kind of at will. You're solving all those barriers right there.
Yeah, and as I said, the trade is that we don't own the network, right? When you run a hotspot in your house, that's your hotspot, right? If a scooter or a, you know, temperature sensor or a wildfire sensor or whatever it is sending data and it's traveling through your hotspot, you're the one getting paid for that, right? Like, we're not getting paid for that. And so, and that's the trade, right? Is that we believe that this is the only sane way to build initially low power networks, but ultimately something like a 5G network as well, where the density of base stations is going to be like orders of magnitude higher than what we've seen with something like LTE or 3G in the past.
And Amir, how many of these do you need to cover a city? I know you said you might mainly need a few, but like, what's the target number do you think for something like New York City to have kind of like dense coverage where I could take a Lime scooter and just circle New York City?
We've always said 100 to 200 is sort of a reasonable number. You know, we were just in New York City last week or two weeks ago for a launch party that we did there. And so we were doing some network testing while we're out there. We didn't really find anywhere in Manhattan that we could go where we weren't being picked up. And I don't know how many hotspots we have there, but I think it's less than 100. So it gives you a sense of the numbers required. And, you know, as there are less buildings and less stuff in the way, and, you know, and as you put the hotspots up higher, so they have better line of sight to the transmitters, you know, you can start to sort of think of rural areas requiring maybe like just only tens of hotspots or something like that rather than hundreds.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I mean, how are the, like, one issue with mesh networking in the past and kind of, you know, Comcast faced this issue when they went from, you know, wireless to Wi-Fi was handoffs. I mean, when you're on a Lime scooter, like, does the handoff between different nodes on your network happen pretty seamlessly?
So that's the handoff issue is really a very cellular specific issue, right? So part of the way cellular networks need to work is that there needs to be sort of a constant communication between, let's say, your phone and a cell tower, right? And it makes sense because if someone calls you, you need to know that call is happening in relatively real time, right? You can't just wait for a few minutes and sort of eventually the call will arrive, right? It's sort of a very real time based system. And so as a result of that, you can think of your phone as being sort of associated with one cell tower at any given time, right? And so as it moves and it sort of gets far away from one cell tower, it has to reassociate with another cell tower. Our system, we don't really have that because our application is very different from a real-time telephony network, right? So we don't have any notion of handoff. What happens is the Lime scooter in your example, like, sends a packet or broadcasts, and every hotspot that's in the area will pick it up and they will effectively race to deliver the packet to the server on the internet. And whoever does that first gets paid for it. And so you get a tremendous amount of redundancy this way, right? We were in New York with a transmitter the other day, and, you know, we had 22 different hotspots picking us up with one transmission. And so it doesn't really matter if one or two of those, you know, are on bad internet connections or if they go down or the power goes out or whatever it is, because you've got 20 others that are going to pick you up, right? And so it's a very different model from a cell model, and that makes life easier when it comes to sensors. If we were trying to do voice this way, it would be a disaster, but we're not trying to do voice yet, so that's not a problem.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, the redundancy is pretty interesting because, I mean, with a cell tower, you generally only have one, you're only pinging one cell tower, right? I mean, with your way, you're kind of having that backup of having like mass redundancy.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, the trade is that you lose any notion of like real time, right? So if you want to send something down to your sensor, your sensor has to sort of be on some kind of schedule to receive that, right? It has to wake up every, you know, minute or something and check to see if there's any messages for it. Whereas with a cell phone, you know, almost instantaneously when someone calls you, you receive that call, right? And so it's not like the cell version is bad. It's just sort of designed for a different application than our network.
Yeah, that makes sense. And sorry for being all over here, but this is super interesting. I mean, so when a platform or a company wants to use you guys, like, let's stay with Lime Scooter just because I love them. I mean, what's the process like for them to use your network versus, you know, using a traditional cell carrier? Like, if I'm a project that needs an IoT network, how do I go about using you guys versus using one of the telecom giants?
So we've tried to, I mean, part of what I think is really important in this space and that has not been done that well is building hardware is really, really difficult. I mean, you've got a lot of like different trade-offs that you have to make, especially for low power hardware like sensors, that you just don't have to make on the internet, right? So if you're used to building like internet applications or web or mobile applications, you know, you never really have to think of things like RAM. But in the low power sort of embedded universe, you've got all sorts of issues with like RAM and like interrupts and timing and, you know, stuff that's just generally hard. And so we've always wanted to try and make that as easy as possible. And so we have a developer portal at developer.helium.com. And there you can grab any of our SDKs. We have a bunch of different things available, a bunch of off-the-shelf hardware, so you don't have to buy anything from us if you don't want to. And you can, you know, just start building a simple device that will work on the network. There's a server side component and we've made that open source too. We call that console. And so when your device sends data, console is the way that you sort of tell it where to go. You know, so if you want that data to be delivered to AWS or if you want it to be delivered to Google Cloud or whatever it may be, that is sort of how you configure that. So you don't have to do much on the device side, right? The device is sort of dumb and simple and just sends data. One of the nice things about this network is that the cost of the hardware compared to something like a cell network is extremely low. We're talking about, you know, maybe needing to add a chip that costs a buck or two onto your existing thing in order to be able to start communicating with the network. There's no sort of concept of something like certification. And there's no real notion of sort of an ongoing plan, so to speak. You just sort of pay hotspots as you use them, and it's, you know, a fraction of what you would pay on a cell network. And so it's very, very easy to get started. It's sort of very permissionless, right? Like you don't need to ask us, you don't need to really ask anyone's permission. You just sort of start doing it. And I think that's sort of very different, right? If you're going to build a device on AT&T or Verizon, there's a very formal process that you have to go through before they're going to allow you to do that because they're, you know, trying to protect the health of their network and all the other stuff that they're doing. So it's a very different idea to just sort of have a thing that's there that you can just use or not use, depending if you know, whenever you choose. You don't really have to ask us or anyone else for permission.
Yeah, you guys bring the barriers way down for developers trying to experiment, which I like. I mean, you know, normal developers in the college dorm room, you know, they're not going to go out to Verizon or AT&T to kind of, you know, set up a business partnership, right? I mean, it's just easier to use you guys. And on the flip side, I mean, it sounds like at $500 a node, if you need, I don't know how many nodes you need to cover the US, but let's say it's 10,000. I mean, you're basically building a network that covers coast to coast for $5 million.
I don't know the number, but yeah, let's say it's something like that, right? And today the hotspots cost $495. You know, we will continuously work over time to try and bring that cost down. We've started to release guides on like how you could build your own hotspot, right? So you don't have to buy it from us necessarily. And you might be able to do that for, you know, $150, $200 or something like that. So yeah, I mean, you're talking about a very different model, and because no one had to like singularly bear the $5 million cost, you know, we can make the cost of using the network significantly lower, right? I mean, one of the challenges with supporting IoT devices on cellular networks is that the cell networks cost tens of billions of dollars to build, but the devices that use the network aren't like iPhones, right? Like we're happy to spend $100 a month or more to get an iPhone on the network with a decent amount of data. But the kinds of use cases that we're talking about, I mean, they sort of squint a little bit when you say a dollar a year, right? And so it's very different, and it's very difficult to sort of recoup any capital invested in networks that if you try and use a traditional model. But because all you're out is $400 or $500 on a hotspot, it's a very different set of economics for you as sort of an individual host.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, diving into kind of incentivizing people on your network, a lot of this comes back to your token economics, right? So I guess how at a high level do you incentivize people to purchase nodes, to kind of use the network, I guess with a focus on your token econ here?
Yeah, so we have two tokens that are in play in our network. If you are a host and you are participating in what we would call mining, you are earning the Helium token. Not a very excitingly named thing, but that's what you get for running a hotspot and participating in what we call proof of coverage, right? Which is a set of challenges that happen over RF that try and prove that you are running a legitimate hotspot. And it works by other hotspots sort of detecting your challenges and reporting them back to the blockchain. And so when that happens, you get rewarded in tokens for sort of helping secure the network and participating honestly in the network. How much you earn, wildly variable depending on how many other hotspots are nearby, how often you get challenged. It's a relatively complicated protocol that can kind of get into here, but maybe a whole separate topic. And then the other type of token on our network is called a data credit. And that's what customers of the network use, right? So if you are a device maker of some kind, like let's say Nestle, who's building devices on the network, you transact in the form of data credits. And data credits are a fixed value thing, right? They always cost $0.00001, and they always allow you to send 24 bytes of data, right? So you can think of them kind of like an AWS compute credit or an Xbox Live point or an airline mile or something like that. It's a non-exchangeable, like non-transferable thing that has fixed value. There's no speculation to it. And so that's very predictable for users of the network, right? You know that if you have a device that transmits a GPS coordinate, you know, 100 times a day, you'll need 100 data credits to do that. And that's going to cost you, you know, $0.0001 or whatever it is to do that. And so it's nice to have those sort of two systems. The data credits get paid directly to the hosts, and the hosts also earn as a result of mining. And so it makes it sort of predictable. We think it's safe from a sort of regulatory point of view because there's no speculation on the data credit side. Like that's a purely sort of utilitarian thing that can only be used in one way. And it gives sort of good visibility to users of the network as to you know how much they're gonna spend to use it, which is a challenge when you have a volatile cryptocurrency.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, so the data credits is more of the medium of exchange, obviously more of a high velocity type credit. I mean, what's the interaction between the Helium tokens and data credits? I guess I'm more wondering about like the long-term value of the Helium token, like what the sync is. Like, do users have to stake it? Do they have to hold it? Is it, you know, are there governance rights? I'm just kind of wondering like where the value capture is for the Helium token.
So we use the system described as the burn and mint equilibrium, which is a system that I think Factum, which is another blockchain project that you might know. I think they are the pioneers of it. And the idea there is that in order to create data credits, you have to burn Helium tokens, right? There's no other way of acquiring data credits. They can only be created as a result of burning Helium tokens. And what burning means is removing them from circulation, right? So if you imagine that a Helium token was a dollar on the public market, if you burned one Helium token, you would end up with whatever that is, 10,000 data credits, right? And that number is going to be fluctuating around because it's a volatile cryptocurrency. And so the demand for data credits will ultimately act as sort of a bigger and bigger sink for Helium tokens, right? As more devices use the network, more Helium tokens have to be burned on a regular basis in order to create data credits that get used on the network. And so we sort of are trying to create inflation and deflation that is based around utility on the network rather than a fixed schedule, right? So like Bitcoin has a fixed schedule. I think Filecoin copied the sort of exact same idea. And we never were super comfortable with that because it didn't reflect real sort of usage on the network, right? If you just had a fixed inflation or deflationary curve. And so our model tries to sort of like, basically, if no one's using the network, there's going to be a ton of inflation and the currency is going to be less valuable. If a lot of people are using the network, there's going to be deflationary pressure and that should increase the value of the Helium token. And so if no one uses this, then the Helium token ends up being worthless. And we think that's the correct way.
No, I mean, that's a fair assessment, right? I was talking to Ben Spragno at the Multicoin team. He's a friend about this and they're obviously big on you guys and they have a great post that I'll link to. But I think kind of one of the takeaways was that like the cool thing about you guys is that your tokens are kind of designed to scale the price as usage increases.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's sort of the key, right? Is that we aren't trying to build a speculative network, right? We're trying to build a network that has genuine utility. We aren't the only people sort of advocating for building an IoT network. We just think we have a better, cheaper, sort of faster way of doing it. But we aren't. There are certainly many, many others, including the telcos, that are sort of going after this space. And so I think that makes life a little bit different from if you look at it from the sort of cryptocurrency point of view. Most of the sort of interesting crypto projects, perhaps with the exception of Filecoin, are trying to get you to do a different thing than what you are already doing today, right? They're trying to get you to build a decentralized application or use a sort of hosted world computer or whatever it may be, which is probably not something you're building towards today because those things don't exist. In our case, like, we know that there's a massive universe of IoT device makers. Some have deployed products, some don't. And so we're just sort of going after those guys that are already looking in this space, that are already trying to build something or know that they have a need to build something, and sort of offering them a better way to do it. And I think that creates the sort of possibility for real utility on a network like this, because we're really not trying to change any behavior. We're just trying to say, use this technology versus that technology because it's cheaper and better. And rather than, you know, do something that you are otherwise never going to plan on doing. And so we think that that's going to be a big driver of utility on a network like this, is that it goes after a space that already has demand, rather than sort of trying to create the demand artificially.
Well, I mean, you're kind of seeing that, right? I mean, you guys have some pretty marquee users. You have Nestle, you have Lime, you have InvisiLeash. I mean, are these pilots with these companies, or are these kind of full-blown deployments? And I mean, I'm obviously not expecting like a full countrywide deployment. I just think it's cool that you guys are able to attract this caliber of customer kind of at an earlier stage.
Yeah, I think it's a great testament to what we're doing. And it's also a great testament to the fact that this is a real problem that people have, right? Is that they know that they want to build an IoT thing. In a lot of cases, like, power is the issue, right? Like, they need something that resembles a cellular network that is very, very low power. And today, there just isn't that. Like, especially in the US, like, there's just no version of that exists. And so this is a really interesting thing. And so we're even managing to sort of lure companies that have already built products on cell networks away from that network and actually building an entirely new variant of a product. And so we'll have a bunch of announcements coming about different customers that we're working with. But it's really nice to see it, because it's sort of a good reminder that the problem that we set out to solve, you know, six something years ago is still a real problem. And I think we found the right way to go about solving it with sort of distributing and decentralizing the ownership of the network.
Hey, everyone. We'll continue this conversation shortly. But first, a quick word from our amazing sponsors. Are you interested in getting into the cryptocurrency markets but don't know where to start building your portfolio? We have the answer for you. It's called CopyTrader by eToro. With CopyTrader, you can automatically copy every trade of eToro's top crypto traders at the exact price in real time. No need to study up on markets or develop your own strategies. Simply sign up and copy the trader of your choice. Any profits they make, you do too. With eToro, you get access to the world's most popular cryptocurrencies with transparent trading fees, all in one easy-to-use app. Copy the smart money with eToro. Join now at b.tc/eToroReaction, linked in the show notes below. So, stupid question for you, Amir, just to round out your token economics, though. But I mean, when you were describing and building the system, what were your thoughts about, you know, not creating your own tokens and just using a stable coin, just using Ether or Bitcoin? Like, what were your thoughts for and against that?
You know, I think I'm a big fan of Bitcoin, especially. Like, I think it's sort of the best example of what a cryptocurrency could and perhaps should be. You know, we debated Lightning Network support as an example, you know, and I don't think that door is closed. Like, we built into our blockchain network the sort of transaction primitives that we need, like hash time lock contracts, to support Lightning. Like, we sort of copied, I think BIP 199 is what defines those contracts. And so we've implemented it the same way. I think it's a thing that we'd like to eventually do. So it would be nice, for example, if users chose that they could pay hotspot hosts in Bitcoin or any Lightning compatible currency. I don't see why we wouldn't allow that in the future. I do think that there's a benefit to sort of trying to create a new economic model that is designed for certain things. You know, I got into a little bit of a discussion with someone the other day that was sort of advocating for, like, there should only be Bitcoin. And I just don't think it works that way, right? Like, there's a convenience factor that sort of comes into play. And it's the same reason that people, like, prepay for cell phone minutes. And it's the same reason that people hold airline miles. And there's sort of a convenience and there's sort of a discount premium. And that, you know, there's a reason that dollars aren't the only thing used for everything all the time. And I think that's sort of the same here. I do think Bitcoin is you know, the king. I agree. But we're not trying to build a network that sort of goes after that, right? We're trying to build a sort of highly usable, low power, wide area network. And so the way that you pay for that and the way you interact with that might be different, and the economics for that are different. And so, you know, we looked at it. I think it's interesting. At first, we started building as an ERC-20 token on top of Ethereum, you know, 3 years ago, and that was not feasible for a whole bunch of reasons. So I like the way we've settled on it. I like the burn and mint model, which I think Factum was really the pioneer of, and Multicoin frankly introduced us to. I like all of that. I really like where we've ended up, but the door certainly isn't closed to using something like Bitcoin or anything Lightning compatible in the future.
That's a fair assessment. I mean, it's a different use case. It's a different protocol. It has different needs and different users. And, you know, one thing users look for when they buy a physical device is kind of their payback period, right? Like, Farboud, who I have a ton of respect for, we have an episode with him. You know, he's the founder of CoinMine, where you could mine crypto kind of, you know, right next to your computer with this Apple looking device, which is awesome. You know, a lot of people though want to know like what their payback period is. Do you guys ever think about that, or do your users, or, you know, is this more of a, you know, purchase a Helium hotspot and this is kind of a 10-year investment?
I mean, it's difficult to say. I mean, it's difficult to say because it's early in the network's life and there's no sort of liquidity to it yet. It's difficult to say because we don't know what we should say from a regulatory point of view. So we just sort of have to stay away from that question and sort of see what happens to some degree. I think what we're seeing is that the early participants in the network that are buying hotspots today are really an interesting mix between crypto enthusiasts and IoT enthusiasts and entrepreneurs. You know, some of these guys are buying in quantity, you know, like I think we just sold 50 to someone this morning. And so they're treating it as a little business that they're running effectively, right? Like they are a network operator in their area. And I think that's really cool. And so I'm guessing the belief there is that if this network were to succeed and people start using it, then they get to sort of participate in the economics of that, whatever it may be. And over time, you know, as the network develops and perhaps, you know, there are exchanges or whatever it is that we aren't sort of actively participating in enabling, we'll see what that looks like. And it's just impossible to say right now. And as I said, even if I knew, I'm not sure I would tell you.
No, that's fair enough. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And it's definitely going to take some time to play out. And, you know, just zooming out kind of at a high level, IoT is for, you know, use cases that don't have to ping the network off in low capacity, right? Use cases. And a lot of pushback on, I think, historical mesh networks was kind of the economics of how this all plays out, right? Because you're not really paying that much a year. Like you said, you know, a dollar a year might get people to squirm on IoT. But it sounds like to me, you're the only ones that could really attack that market because you're decentralizing all of the costs and the infrastructure and then supporting it with your own token. Is that kind of the right way to think about it, or is that kind of a bad summation?
No, I think that's our summation. I mean, that's the perfect way of looking at it, is that there isn't a way to do this without deploying the network this way or eating massive losses. And I'm not sure any of the telcos are really up for that right now.
Just to close out, I mean, I want to talk about, you know, what happens when you guys are wildly successful, right? I mean, does Verizon and AT&T come to you guys for IoT coverage, or do you kind of put their IoT out of business? Like, what's the ultimate end game for you guys?
That's a really good question. You know, for us, I think we see this as just the start of a new way of people deploying wireless networks, right? I mean, so far, you know, if you wanted to sort of think about how you would, so as an example, like at home, I only have one broadband provider. I have Comcast. They have a cable going to my house. That's sort of it. If I don't like Comcast, there's not really a whole lot I can do about it. And so that's been difficult to infiltrate that world, right? Like if you as an individual or even as a company, you know, wanted to sort of take on that world, that's a really, really tough thing to do. And so what I think, or what I hope Helium has accomplished, you know, by the time that we're done, is that we have created a new way for people to think about deploying network infrastructure. Today, that's IoT, right? That's low power things. for two reasons. Like, one, we think it is the least well-served space in telecom today. Like, there just isn't a good solution for that. And two, quite frankly, it's just easier, right? You can create a hotspot that backhauls off consumer internet and creates, you know, tens of miles of network coverage. Like, you can't do that, you know, with higher bandwidth things. But eventually, you know, we would imagine, like I mentioned a couple times in the podcast already, you know, the companies are talking about 5G network deployments, but they're not really being honest about it, right? I mean, 5G has a range that's, you know, should realistically be measured in like single meters, right? Because it gets interfered with by humidity and glass. And, you know, it's like a disaster in terms of propagation and distance. And so no one's ever really going to deploy 5G networks in the same way that LTE networks have been deployed. And so we're sort of starting to think that the only way that you might deploy something like a 5G network is if you co-opted a community to do it. And so at that point, you're like, okay, well, why not create a different model for those operators to sort of share in the economics rather than building Verizon's network for them or something, right? And so that's what we hope to accomplish. And what that end game looks like in terms of, you know, is Verizon mad at us or, you know, how does it play? I don't know. But I do think there's a real shot here, and 5G is a really interesting sort of inflection point where the infrastructure cost is going to be too high even for multi-billion dollar telcos to swallow.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not, like, to your point, it's definitely an achievable goal, right? I mean, Starry Wireless is a wireless company in Boston that really took off, and they're using kind of shared spectrum to beam internet to people's houses, and these people just put a node on their window and they pay $40 a month, you know?
Yeah, so we shared investor with Starry. First Mark Capital invested in us and in Starry. So we know those guys and we know Chet well. And I think what they're doing is awesome. And that's, you know, another vector of attack on the same problem, right? Is that there should be another way to get access to a network. And it's harder, right? Like, you've got to have like fiber backhaul for these things, you know, if you're really sharing 5G. And so the proposition is very different than just sort of connect this thing to your home Wi-Fi. But it's definitely doable. And I think if the upside for you as a 5G hotspot host, if you could imagine it, was that people are paying you hundreds of dollars a month in or even thousands or more a month in aggregate because you are sort of the network operator for them in their home and they're streaming Netflix through you, whatever, you know, that's going to be lucrative. And then people are going to want to do that. And you gain the benefit of not having to bootstrap new devices, right? Like, people will be able to use their existing iPhones and existing stuff on this network that you're creating. And so it's super interesting. There's a whole world of pain and challenges that come with it, which is why we're sort of staying far away from it for now. But that's where I would like this to go, is that when people think about deploying outdoor sort of wide area network infrastructure, that they look to sort of our blockchain and our way of doing things as sort of a blueprint for how to do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things me and my friends are, you know, Tim McDonald is a close friend. He's at Penn Capital. And my old boss, Tim Horan, who's the cloud MD at Oppenheimer, we talk about you guys a lot. And one of the things that always comes up is kind of like, you know, what happens if Amazon rolls out like IoT support on their, you know, Alexa devices and puts that in every home? Or I'm just wondering, like, what happens if one of the giants kind of enters your space? Or is that kind of the question for every startup?
I mean, they are doing that. I don't know if you saw their announcement, but they have a product called Sidewalk. And that is basically the same idea as us, right? It's like, buy this device, stick it in your house, and create a wireless network. And the initial product that they have in mind is something called Ring Fetch, which is a dog collar. And that's what will use the network. And so we don't know a whole lot about it yet. They haven't sort of enumerated like why someone would do this or how the sharing part of it works or anything to do with that. But, you know, I do hope that people eventually get tired of sort of the surveillance capitalism model. You know, it sort of sucks that we all know that everyone is listening to us all the time and knows everything about us and everything that we do. And that's how sort of the consumer internet works, right? That's how it's paid for. And I hope that starts to change over time. And I think, you know, allowing more big company wireless networking devices around your house is probably a bad idea. And so I hope that our sort of open model, that our economic model, which sort of really provides a proper incentive for people to do this, is better than, you know, you get to use a dog collar on the network. That's sort of our hope. And for us, we view that as a tremendous validation of what we're doing, right? The fact that someone like Amazon views this as a problem that they need to solve in basically a similar way to the way that we're solving it, rather than use an existing cell network, you know, means that the existing cell networks are inadequate, right? And so I think that, or it partially means that are inadequate. It also means they probably have other intentions with their network. But I think that to me was very validating as someone who's been in the space for several years and sort of has clung to this belief that it has to be done a different way. So for us, it was nice to see. It's certainly been helpful in a lot of ways, but who knows? Maybe it will come to kill us all and I'll regret saying all of this.
Well, I mean, to your point, Amazon could solve the supply side and put a device in every home, right? But they can't incentivize people to actually buy that device, right? You guys are incentivizing people through tokens to actually be a part of the network.
Yeah, and I think their incentive might be that you get to use a consumer product as a result, right? Like if you want a dog collar and their dog collar is good, you know, maybe that's a good enough incentive. I don't know what incentive you have beyond that. So for example, like why would I share it with someone else? But again, they haven't released much about it. It's difficult to say what they have in mind. Maybe they have a similar sort of sharing economy model in mind. Who knows? There are some practical, you know, issues with putting it in something like an Alexa. You know, so when we ran our Echo device at home, you know, it was in the kitchen next to a toaster in the corner, right? That's not going to be creating a very broad network for anyone outside of your house. And so I do think that there are some physical challenges. You know, if you use like an outdoor light or a doorbell or something, you would probably end up being in a better spot there. So there are some challenges. There are some, you know, alternative ways of doing it. I'm sure they're looking at all of it. But at the end of the day, it's more like, do you want to participate in a real economic system or do you want to do the sort of tit for tat model, which is sort of the way something that like Fawn or something has worked over time. And that's sort of the difference, right? We think that this is the first time that someone has really tried to deploy a wireless network with a different economic model. And so time will tell whether that is as valuable as we think it is.
Fair enough. And two last questions for you. I know you got to run, but these are definitely worth it. I mean, the other question I have is how much of the existing internet do you guys use? Like, I mean, when people think about this, like I have to have a broadband connection to my house, which most people do. But then from the internet provider layer, I'm kind of thinking, all right, is Helium kind of just reselling my internet? Or I'm just wondering how much overlap there is there.
I mean, we definitely rely on the internet a lot, right? I mean, once packets get to a hotspot, they ultimately have to be delivered to somewhere on the internet for them to be usable, right? And at least in our model, I know mesh networking guys would probably disagree with that. But in our model, you know, it's sort of device sends to hotspot sends to server somewhere on the internet. You know, we have a nice architecture which allows that server to be literally any server you want. It doesn't need to come to us, but ultimately it does need to travel over the internet and get there. You know, you could imagine a world where that part wasn't needed and the hotspots sort of created their own network among themselves. But then I think you start to get into dangerous territory of trying to sort of rebuild AWS or something on a blockchain. And that to me has never really sounded like a good idea. So yeah, today we're very dependent on the sort of the real internet existing and being able to have access to it. But eventually, like I said, I think there is a universe where, you know, you could imagine like super hosts or something that were connected directly to POPs or in COs that sort of served as the hub for other hotspots. And so you weren't, you know, backhauling over Comcast or whatever. You were using someone else who's participating in our network rather than an existing provider. So you could imagine that world existing. Again, it's just like baby steps. You know, you sort of have to start somewhere with all of this stuff. And this is where we've chosen to start.
Yeah, no, I mean, once you get one super node on a tower, you'll have a ton of coverage and capacity, which would be interesting. And
yeah.
Amir, last question for you. What's next for Helium? How do you go from 1,600 nodes to 10,000, 100,000? What are your next steps?
So international is a big one for us. So we recently opened an office in Berlin. So we intend, I think the target is Q2 next year to be selling in the EU and parts of Southeast Asia. So that's a big deal for us. There's a massive both IoT and sort of cryptocurrency base there. I think onboarding customers and devices on the network is another really, really important thing for us. They have a long tail, you know, like someone needs to build and prototype and test and deploy a production device. You might be talking about months or years for that to happen. So we're very active in getting developers and big enterprises and SIs sort of bootstrapped on the network and the technology. And then the economic side is the other part. Unfortunately, this is a part that we really can't play any part in from a regulatory point of view. But as sort of the crypto economic side of this starts to take off and starts to become more liquid, I would expect that to be a driver of people's behavior as well. So those are, to me, the three main things that are that can drive adoption. And I think international is definitely a huge deal.
Exciting times. Amir, thanks so much for coming on, and just let people know where they could follow you or learn more about Helium.
Yeah, so we're at helium.com. So we got a lot of info there. If you're a developer, check out developer.helium.com. If you want to join the network, which we would love for you to do, the easiest way is to buy a hotspot. We have them for sale right now. I think there's a promo going on right now over the holidays. So if you go to helium.com/store, you can go buy a hotspot today. And I think there's a hot chocolate promo of some kind going on. So you can probably find that on our Twitter account.
No, for sure. And I'll have Helium's links and your Twitter and everything in the show notes. Everyone could just scroll down and check you guys out and hopefully order a node. Should be interesting. And Amir, I want to thank you again for your time. I know you're busy. It's really a great episode.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been great to chat. I love that you have a little bit of a telco background as well. It makes this conversation a lot more interesting.
Yeah, hopefully not too rusty at this point. But until next time, Amir.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.